This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Consent. Consent can be loosely defined as actively agreeing to be sexual with someone, to give permission. Sexual activity without consent is considered rape or sexual assault. But what exactly constitutes consent, and can it be withdrawn? I'm Dashrant Johan, and this is Today I Learned. On the show with me today is Janelle Tan. She's the Information and Communications Officer at the All Women's Action Society, also known as AWAM. Welcome to the show, Janelle. Before we break things down, break down the different elements of consent, could you perhaps define what exactly consent is within the context of relationships and sexual relationships?
Thank you, Dashrant, once again for having me. It's great to be back. So if I were to summarize in short, right, consent would encompass three things. The first thing is actually to respect your own and also your partner's bodily autonomy, i.e. boundaries. The second thing is to make sure to treat your partner with due care and consideration in relation to the first point that I've mentioned. And the last but not least is if you're at all unsure as to whether your partner is into what you're doing, then you should pretty much err on the side of caution and pretty much take it as a no. For the contrast of the Malaysian law generally against like what is supposed to be. So if you look at rape laws, for instance, so consent is very much enshrined in rape, right? As in like sexual intercourse would constitute as rape if there is no consent. And in the case of consent, when consent is given, for example, it's when the woman is manipulated or deceived or coerced and et cetera and et cetera. So consent is very much clearly stipulated. It plays as part of a narrative that tells society whereby, oh, you only need consent for, you know, the ultimate, which is sexual intercourse. But it's also important to remember that consent should be similarly applied to everything. Like, I mean everything, as in even for something as mild as kissing or even holding hands. So consent is very much needed in those as well, because those are the respective forms of intimate activity. And that involves crossing a person's individual boundaries. So consent is very much needed as well.
Now, are there any general rules of thumb or even tenets when it comes to consent?
So according to the Planned Parenthood definition of consent, right, there are actually five characteristics. I'll just list them down.
Right.
First one is freely given. Second one is informed. Third one is enthusiastic. The fourth is specific. And the fifth is reversible.
All right. So let's go through each one of those tenets and see, you know, what exactly they entail and what do they mean. So when it comes to freely given, right, what exactly does that mean?
So freely given by that, it means that consent is given when the person is not coerced to give consent. When the person gives consent, the person is in full mental capacity. By that, I mean like being fully conscious, not under the influence of a mind-altering substance. So by that, I think, you know, things like alcohol and drugs, right, and et cetera, or narcotics. So that's pretty much freely given. Based on what I generally know, right, you know, when it comes to drugs and alcohol, it's a super murky area to deal with, even from the laws, from the legal standpoint. And this is pretty much seen, like, even in Western countries. For example, like, some Western laws, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's the US one, I think they still have this clause whereby it will constitute as rape if, for example, alcohol is given, you know, it's administered to the person, or the drug is administered to the person without the person's consent. So in that, to put it in other words, rape is rape when, like, the person is forced or coerced or through some other indirect way, you know, like being given with alcohol or drugs. Of course, you know, in general situations, like, a lot of us would pretty much, you know, take alcohol, for example, at our own volition. It's not exactly administered to us directly. So in that sense, it's pretty much it's an outlaw. But alcohol, I'm just going to talk about alcohol because it's actually the most common date rape drug, even more than Rohypnol.
Right.
That actually surprised me when I came across it. But if you would look at alcohol, right, there is a range, you know, because there are so many factors to take into account. Like, I mean, people have different thresholds when it comes to being intoxicated, right? Some people can drink so many glasses or pints of beer and they won't get drunk, but then some people may have a reverse effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the general rule to apply would be consent cannot be freely given when the person is too intoxicated. So general symptoms that you can probably rely on would be, I'm sure we would know, like, you know, when you are too intoxicated or too drunk, you will see things like they can't walk properly, you know, like, i.e. loss of coordination and balance. You know, when they can't speak properly, i.e. slurred speech, and especially impaired judgment. So we all know that alcohol, when taken at very high amounts, your judgment, your decision-making skills are pretty much impaired. So when you do see symptoms like that, then you can take it as a general rule that, you know, you shouldn't push your boundaries and see the person safely home and don't do anything.
You know, when we talk about, you know, giving freely, right? If you get married, does that automatically mean that consent is permanently freely given or attained?
the I do, right? No, by right, I mean, the general societal assumption is that I do would include allowing, you know, like allowing the person to have sex with you whenever they want. But in reality, that shouldn't be the case, because once again, sexual intercourse and any other form of intimate or activity or sexual activity involves crossing the person's personal boundaries. As a result, you should ask for consent. Even though you may be in a long-term relationship, and in the case, you know, in a relationship of matrimony with your partner. In most cases, a lot of us actually take it for granted that just because, especially in long-term relationships, including marriage, you know, like just because you have had, you know, have done certain things with the person in the past, they assume that, oh, if I do it again, this person will definitely say yes. So this is something that should be taken into, this one is something that should be taken note of, and we will probably explore it in another one of the characteristics of consent. But yes, marriage in general, it should not be assumed to be automatic consent in the context of sexual activity.
Right. Now, one thing we sometimes tend to hear when it comes to cases, perhaps involving sexual assault allegations and whatnot, is that you hear a lot of people, albeit in social media or whatnot, who say, you know, that girl was flirting. You know, you often hear this defense from the perpetrators themselves, you know, that woman or that individual was flirting. They were making sexual jokes. They were teasing me. They were making crude jokes. Some people also say, you know, look at the outfit that someone is wearing. Well, what is your take on it? Do the jokes a person make or you know, a person flirting or even the type of clothes a person wear, do these constitute as consent or invitation?
So to answer that, I'll bring in one terminology which I came across when I was reading a book about sexual consent quite some time ago. So there's this terminology that's called contractual model of consent. So this basically conveys the idea that certain non-sexual actions by one partner is seen to obligate the other person, in most cases the woman, to have sex with the man. If I to put it even more simply, so actions that are completely unrelated to sex or consent are taken to mean as expressions of consent, when by right, all these things, you know, like sex and all other intimate activities, by right, they should require consent separately. But somehow, for some reason, due to our society and perceptions and all the sexual scripts, right? These things, as we've mentioned, Darshan, like, for example, wearing very sexy clothing, flirting, accepting drinks from men, inviting someone to your home. So these somehow are seen as expressions or permission for consent, which by right should not be the case. And if I were to put a pattern here, like for everyone to see, right? Like if you look at it this way, right? Wearing sexy clothing, go to the bar, flirt with the person, accept drinks from a man, then probably, you know, agree to go to someone's home, invite the person to your home, and then you have sex. So do you see this linear progression? So this one, if I were to frame it in humanities terms, right, it's like a it's like a script that we all follow. And we see this script in so many, so many media, especially in mass media, in movies, in series, whatever, and how people tell you, you know, how things are meant to happen. So this script pretty much shapes the way what we think about sex and how it should take place. And it also informs all of us, like men and women, as to like what can be read as consent. And especially with the last part as to what I've mentioned, what can be read as consent, that pretty much violates what we now understand to be consent, as in, you know, you're supposed to ask for consent or understand, make sure that the person is comfortable with whatever that you're doing sexually and intimately. So in short, flirting and sexual jokes and wearing short skirts and whatnot, they should not be counted as consent that's freely given. Rather, they should be seen as non-sexual related actions. And when you do come to the stage where you want to perform physical intimacy with the other person, right? Then you should either ask or look at the person's body language and see if the person's okay, and then proceed as appropriate.
Right. So another thing as well is you tend to hear this defense sometimes when, you know, people talk about child marriage cases or even, cases where, you know, a high school teacher, has sexual relations with her student or with his student. What you tend to hear sometimes is that, oh, these people weren't coerced into it, you know, into it. These children, these students were not coerced into it. They wanted it. It was on their own volition. They gave permission. They gave the consent. My question is, can a child, can someone who is not legally classified as an adult give consent freely?
So just to put it out there, that generally across the world, even in UK, for example, right, in Malaysia as well, the age of consent, legal consent for sex, okay, so the age of legal consent for sex is actually 16 years old, and that's pretty much across the world. And just to let everyone know that there's actually a difference between the general consent that we know and legal consent. So just because a child says yes or acts willingly, if the child is 15 years old and below, it still does not imply consent. So in the case of sexual intercourse, right, even if the child consents to do it, a child aged 15 and below consents to do it, automatically it would constitute a statutory rape. No question about that. So a child's permission, age 15 and below, does not excuse the adult from taking full responsibility for whatever they did. It doesn't matter physical sexual assault, non-physical sexual assault, or even rape. And the Sexual Offences Against Children Act 2017 is very clear about in stipulating, it is very comprehensive in the sense that it protects the child from all forms of sexual assault, physical and non-physical, including pornography. So on that note, a child aged 15 and below in our country cannot give consent freely. The law, the premise behind such a, age of consent is pretty much based on developmental psychology in a way, because if you look at adolescence, it's basically a period of time where the brain undergoes maturational changes. And with that comes with, increased impulsivity, increased vulnerability to risk-taking behavior, being more easily influenced by peer pressure. So if you take into account these developmental changes, right? So technically speaking, a child, I'm not saying all of them, definitely, because there are some cases where a child is very much more mature than the rest of their counterparts, right? But in general, given the maturational changes, a child may not be as rationally able to evaluate the risks when it comes to specific things, especially sexual activity. So in light of that, a child aged 15 and below, even if they say yes, you should not take it as consent and proceed. You should rather, maintain a relationship of trust.
On the show with me today is Janelle Tan of the All Women's Action Society, AWAM. After the break, I ask her if someone needs to ask for consent beforehand or if the onus is on individuals to say no if and when they feel uncomfortable. Keep it here on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today is Janelle Tan, Information and Communications Officer at the All Women's Action Society, also known as AWAM, and she's giving me the 101 on consent. So, Janelle, the second element, or the second tenet that you brought up is this idea that consent is reversible. What exactly do you mean by this?
So, reversible basically means that a consent can be withdrawn at any time. So, even though you may say yes to a particular sexual act or intimate act at the very beginning, if you feel uncomfortable at any point and if you want to put a stop to it and say no, yes, you can definitely say no. So the premise behind this characteristic is that consent should be a continuous yes. So as long as it's broken, it's not valid already. So a person may be comfortable, for example, with hand-holding in a particular situation. But let's say if either the situation continues on and the person becomes uncomfortable, or in another different situation and the person feels uncomfortable about holding hands, then the reversible characteristic comes in where the person can say no.
Right.
So that's an example.
So can you give consent non-verbally? And on that same note, right, can consent be then withdrawn non-verbally as well?
Yes, definitely. We have to take... So this is another very important thing to take note lah. Consent negotiation, this whole thing, right, is actually also very context dependent. So it's not as simple as, you know, like, I mean, if it were as simple, I mean, it would be a lot more easier if it were to be as simple as I explicitly say yes or no, lah. But of course, you know, when it comes to social emotional cues, everything is just very subjective and very dependent on the social situation, right? So in that sense, giving or withdrawing consent, I mean, when it comes to understanding whether the person is actually giving or withdrawing consent, you need to look at a few factors here. Things like, for example, like how long you've known the person, or if the person it feels comfortable enough to tell you explicitly. Like, let's say if the person does not feel comfortable, then obviously they're not going to tell you yes or no directly. Then obviously they're going to use other ways to communicate that to you. So you have to take note of that factor, for example. So in that sense, consent being given non-verbally, for just to give a couple examples, like let's say if you're okay with proceeding further, so they may respond with indirect non-verbal cues like touching or kissing. So that can be, to some extent, can be taken as a sign to proceed further. In the case of consent being withdrawn non-verbally, it really depends, because some may those who are not comfortable, you know, like relaying it directly, can use like less direct ways, like, you know, using your hands to lightly push or keep the person at a distance. So that's an example. But then you also have examples where in the case of especially violence, dating violence, or, you know, sexual assault or sexual harassment, right, the person is just so scared or didn't know how to react that they don't have any non-verbal gestures at all. So even such passive behavior can be construed as withdrawal of consent. It's just that it's not so easily read. That's why consent is not as simple as explicitly asking or explicitly letting the person know that you're okay or not okay with that. It's a mix of both, and it really varies from person to person and from situation to situation. But overall, this whole question, right, pretty much I think it boils down to a few things that need to be remembered here. One is that for some people, or many actually, I mean, if you don't look at sexual situations, and even if you extrapolate it out to general social situations, right, saying no is not easy already, right? You know, when you want to say no, normally we try to make it as polite as possible, right?
Right, that's a good point. Yeah.
So you say things like, you know, I'm really sorry, like, I'm busy. You know, you come up with excuses to try to decline so that it's not so offensive, right? Things like, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm busy right now. You know, can we do it another time? Or you say in other ways, like, you know, not right now, but maybe later, you partially accept it, but you defer it. So if we already do something like this in general social situations, by right, we should be extrapolating the same thing when it comes to acceptance of the range of refusals in sexual situations. So that's one thing that I definitely learned when I read about consent and I reflected on it. Another thing that I think will be very, very important to remember is there are so many reasons why you know, like, people are not able to communicate refusals so directly. There are so many reasons why people will say no in different ways. And from there, we would learn how to read cues better. and not put the responsibility on, you know, the receiver or in the case women, to say no or yes or just to consent without also putting equal responsibility on the other partner.
Now, another tenet you brought up is enthusiastic and that consent must be given enthusiastically. What do you mean by this?
So enthusiastic basically means being able to provide an active yes instead of silence or hesitant agreement or omitting to give an answer entirely. So that's pretty much enthusiastic. La. And yes, it also relates back to consent can be withdrawn, the reversible characteristic. La. So it's very much interrelated.
Does this enthusiastic consent need to be expressed verbally?
That's the tricky question because, yeah, it's very highly favorable, but then we cannot expect this of everyone in every situation. So I would say the non-verbal expressions of enthusiastic consent also apply here. La. So it's really a matter of respecting your, pretty much reading the cues of your partner in that situation. And basically going back to what I've said way earlier, if you're not at all sure as to whether your partner is up to whatever that they do, whatever that you want to do, err on the side of caution and don't do it and don't push boundaries.
Another thing you brought up earlier is this element of being informed. Can you break this down a little bit for us?
Informed consent basically is how also you would expect, even in the case of medical treatments or you sign, when you sign any form, is that consent is given when you fully understand the risks and benefits of performing the said action. And it's based on a mutual understanding of both parties and there should not be any deception involved. So basically, the consent that's made on the information that is fully understood by both parties at the same plane.
So within that, right, for example, is the removal of a condom without informing or seeking permission a violation of consent? And what I mean by that is, let's say both parties have agreed 100% that they do want to have sex. So that there's no arguments there. But the condition put on the table is the condom needs to be used so that and then only we're going to have sex. What if midway throughout through the intercourse a condom is just removed, like the guy removes the condom without informing the woman? Is that a violation of consent?
100%. Because in this case, consent is conditional on protected sex.
Right.
So when you, even when you move halfway, right, or even towards the end, right, that's already a violation of consent. It's as simple as that, lah. Just to add on a bit as to like, so this whole phenomenon is actually called stealthing.
Mm-hmm.
So stealthing, right, like it violates. It violates consent, but the more serious consequences actually involve the disempowering violation of the woman's bodily autonomy, because by doing that you're pretty much putting the woman on at risk of at very, very unwarranted risk of unwanted pregnancies and STIs. So yes, in general, stealthing is a very disempowering violation of consent.
And on that same note, you brought up STIs, right? So what if, two individuals, they meet and they agree to have sexual intercourse. One of the individuals, it can be the guy, it can be the lady, they have, let's say, a particular STI or an STD, which they got because of their past sexual relations and whatnot. They didn't mention it because perhaps they were feeling shy or whatever reasons, people sometimes they don't want to reveal certain things about themselves. So this individual, they have STIs. The other person that they're going to have sex with does not know about this. And then they agree to have sex. Again, the sex part is not in question here. Both agreed. And then the individual who didn't know about it the next day or the next week or what, he does an STI or STD test and he finds out that, oh, now I got something, because I caught one of an STI because I had sex with this partner of mine. Is that a violation of consent? The fact that you're not revealing all the information that may impact this other person's health?
We can assume, even though both sides may not, to some extent, I think it goes back to the very indirect social cues or assumptions.
Right.
So I think the general that we can go by is when we do have sexual intercourse, we somehow assume that both partners would be healthy.
Right.
I guess that's pretty much a cue that's very much taken for granted lah, in a lot of sexual relations. So disclosure would be very, very much necessary. So in a way, you can say that it's a violation of consent because the consent is conditional in that when the person agrees to have sex with that person who is infected with STD, right? The assumption or rather, I think the understanding that the partner had was that, you know, it would just be any normal sexual intercourse, like with a person without STI. So in a way, it's a violation, although it's not as clear-cut law, of course. But then by law, right, our Malaysian laws do exposing the partner to the risk of infection, including STIs. That's pretty much enshrined in our law, specifically under the Prevention and Control of Infectious Diseases Act 1988. And to be wrapped to penal code. So actually that's enshrined in our law. So one can be penalized for this one. It applies to everyone, like literally everyone, including sex workers. With sex workers, it's a very complicated morality dilemma for many, many people because of the stigma attached to the profession, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the same principle applies to sex workers as well. So if you think about it, they only provide sexual services. So conditional in that sexual services are provided when there is a financial transaction. So that's one example. And a lot of people may not apply the same, you know, assumption, premises here, but a sex worker can also, you know, refuse to do certain acts because they may not be comfortable doing it. So for example, a sex worker may not perform oral sex, but they only may perform intercourse because of XYZ reasons, right? So, and by right, that should be respected as well. So the conditional clause actually applies to everyone.
Whole idea that consent is reversible and so on and so forth also apply to sex workers? This idea that, you know, I've already paid the money and I'm going, we go into the room and then like the sex worker maybe 5 minutes into it or for whatever reason is like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Can the sex worker withdraw the consent then?
Should be able to withdraw consent, by right, they should be able to, because the sex worker can also feel uncomfortable. Let's say if the sex worker suddenly feels uncomfortable by that client, right, mm-hmm. or they may feel for their own safety, for whatever reason, they should be able to, it's not a question, and there's no question about it, they should be able to withdraw consent and get out of the situation. It's not like, you know, just because I've paid you money, then you should be able to, you know, like stay all the way to the end. No.
We move on to the final tenet, and that is specific consent. Mm. And consent needs to be specific. What do you mean by this?
So specific basically means that it can apply to across action and time. So for example, right, you know, like just because I've said yes to touching or holding hands, does that mean I'm saying yes to kissing? Mm. So that the action-specific element of comes in. So just because you have said yes to hand-holding, it does not mean that you are comfortable with kissing. So that's action specific. For time specific, that means that just because you said yes to holding hands again in the very beginning in another situation, it does not mean that I'm equally comfortable and I should say yes to holding hands in another situation in the future. So that's specific. So it only applies to that specific action at a specific time. You're not supposed to extrapolate it across either a spectrum of behaviors or for the same action for future instances. It's not supposed to be extrapolated.
Right. Now, with all of whatever we've discussed in mind, right, when we talk about consent, should someone ask for consent before getting into a sexual relationship, before doing physical activity, physically intimate activities and so on and so forth? Or is the onus on individuals to say no if and when they feel uncomfortable?
I think it should be both sides.
Okay.
Because generally, we tend to, if you notice, right, when it comes to a lot of the campaigns, as much as the intention is good, a lot of the campaigns actually put responsibility on the women, for example, mm-hmm. or the receiving partner, to say no explicitly. I think this is too disproportionate because when it comes to a sexual encounter or even for any form of intimate activity, right, it actually involves two people. So two people should how do I say, consent is literally a mutual process where both partners should be communicating with one another. It doesn't matter verbal or non-verbal,
right?
And it includes that whole chunk of like being able to understand the person's social cues and you know, like clarifying and etc. So it's a two-person, it needs two hands to clap, it's not just one.
All right, on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Janelle.
Thank you.
That was Janelle Tan of the All Women's Action Society, AWAM, giving me the lowdown on consent. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcast from. Just have to look up Today I Learned podcast. I'm Dashran Johan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.